Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's all things political for this Monday, the 7th of June. The second hour of our program this Monday, Nancy Pearl will be with us. She's currently writing a book on travel adventures, travel books, and we'll ask for your favorite travel books, and also we'll get suggestions for books that you may want to take with you as you travel, either on your armchair or going someplace over the course of the summer months. We have a great deal to talk about. We'll start with, I think, jobs and then move to, no, we'll start with the oil spill. It's on everybody's mind. And we'll look at jobs and the war in Afghanistan and other political topics that you would like to have us address this hour. We have two guests. Charles Franklin is joining us the first half hour. E.J. Dionne will be with us the second half hour. Professor Charles Franklin is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-founder of Pulse. Star.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That address, talk@wpr.org. Professor Charles Franklin, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's good to be here. Yeah. I have to say it's pollster.com, not Polestar.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As in political polls rather than that star that sits up by the North Pole somewhere.
Maybe there's one of those, too. I didn't mean to get
That's all mixed up.
It's
been done before.
Okay.
But I'm glad to be here, and we've got an interesting agenda today.
Yes, we do. We have a lot going on. Let's start with the Gulf. David Axelrod has said nobody can look at the response of this administration and say we were slow in doing what we were doing. And then he pointed to a range of steps that the president took right from the beginning. He added, we didn't communicate it very well. Where is the truth in all of that?
Well, the last sentence, we didn't communicate it very well, is clearly absolutely true. I think it's probably likely that the administration did move quickly on some things, but that response appeared largely invisible, I think, through the news media. And certainly it took 4, 5, 6 weeks before the administration realized that they had to be more visible in their response. They've slowly come around to that now.
And why haven't they been more visible? It's such a huge event. It's hard to know exactly when the president outlined what he was doing on his Saturday radio address. There's quite a bit of help going down there, but I didn't know it.
Exactly. And I think it's kind of strange. One part of it is apparently media access. My understanding is that the press has been not exactly banned, but they have a standoff region around the oil well and the ships there. And so we've actually seen very little coverage from the site of the disaster.
Yes.
And that may be partly a matter of logistics. It may be part of BP not wanting press available. But I find it one of the surprising things. You would think that it would be in BP's interest to have video coming, showing people working hard every day, running those robots under the sea and everything. After all, that's compelling television on the Discovery Channel. You would think that showing the robots working on it would be compelling here. Likewise, the cleanup ships out in the Gulf. My understanding is there's a lot of skimmers out there working to skim the oil, but we don't see very much of that. Maybe it's just because it's offshore, but I think that part has not been very well handled. But the other side, the one that I think is more damaging, is showing beaches with oil on them and mm-hmm. the booms having washed up on the shore and not a living soul in white suits around to clean up.
Right.
That, I think, is the far more devastating thing and also the one that's literally hitting closer to home.
Right. And then the pictures of those pelicans covered in oil. If I see another one, every time I see it, I have the same reaction. It just gets me right in the stomach. It is so sad and sickening.
They are unbelievable photographs, and the sequence that came out towards the end of last week just drove home that this is not a light oil spill. You know, I think one of the critical things was yesterday the Coast Guard said that Admiral Allen, who's the commander, said that you know, you have to understand that this cleanup is going to last into the fall no matter what. And so while there was good news that the this latest capping of the well has managed to be to recover, I think they said, about 10,000 barrels a day. So it's significantly cutting into the spillage. The fact is we have, what, 47 or 48 days of spill already in the water, and we're going to have whatever else goes into August when the relief wells supposedly cut off the flow. And so that oil is going to be landing on shores throughout the summer, through into the fall. And I thought the Admiral Allen recognizing that yesterday drives home the fact that no matter what happens at the well itself over the next few months, the consequences of this on the beaches are going to continue. And that means for the political side that the administration is faced with an ongoing disaster that it can't just turn the faucet off on.
Right, and it will just continue. So what are the political consequences for not only the administration, but also the oil industry?
Well, I think the oil industry is probably the people that are probably more upset with BP than anybody. Here, President Obama had become the first Democrat in living memory to argue for offshore drilling and an expansion of that. He famously gave a speech in which he said, these rigs are very safe. They really don't have disasters anymore. You know, and within weeks of that, this happens. So the oil companies that were expecting to be able to expand their offshore operations now are faced with this and a very uncertain regulatory future. The other side of this is that public opinion had shifted on offshore drilling. Until a couple of years ago, before the 2008 presidential campaign, a small majority, a little over 50%, said that we should favor environmental concerns over energy production. In the wake of the 08 campaign and the Republicans' drill, baby, drill chants at the convention, that flipped. And for the first time in decades, more people favored energy exploration than protecting the environment. Now, in the 6 weeks since then, it's flipped back to over 50% saying favor the environment. And so the energy exploration industry, as well as the president's political position on this, have really taken a huge hit.
Why doesn't the president get on TV and say that he's going to regulate the heck out of this industry?
I think that's an interesting question. They have certainly made some efforts to appear to be bringing the Minerals Management Agency that's directly in charge of this into line. The head of it was forced out last week. And so there is some element of that. And there's this investigation panel that will look into, you know, exactly what went wrong and so on. But I think that this is going to be a perfect source of hearings and criticism, both of government regulation and its failures, and in the case of BP, its apparent very poor safety record in comparison to other oil companies.
Yes.
I think one of the questions here is how much will this be something that really blows back at BP specifically, as opposed to the other oil companies that by apparently most accounts have far fewer safety violations than BP does.
Let's move to the economy for a moment from one bad piece of news to another.
We're a happy morning.
Yeah, today, I know. I know. There's not a lot of good news out there. The jobs picture is not very great. The administration was hoping there would be more jobs created, but it evidently was census temporary worker jobs. What can be done to stimulate the economy? The president has said that's a hallmark of his first year in office. He wasn't able to create the number of jobs that he wanted to. What's stopping the administration from doing a job stimulus program? What needs to be done to lower that pretty high unemployment rate?
Right. The jobs picture was really mixed last month. It did add a lot of jobs, but almost all of them were government jobs, were the temporary census jobs, as you said. And that was a surprise. Economists had forecast 550,000 new jobs with over 100,000 in the private sector, and it turned out we got less than 40,000 in the private sector. So that was the big letdown that that confounded expectations. In contrast, the month before, the economy had actually produced more private sector jobs with less census hiring. And so it's a very mixed picture, and I think it's in flux. The other side of this is that we got the gross domestic product figures coming out in the last month showing that the first quarter grew at a pretty healthy 3.2% rate, but that was down from a 5% plus rate in the last quarter of 2009. So there's some real uncertainty about whether the growth rate is going to continue to be high enough to offset job losses and start to actually rebuild employment. I think part of the problem on the policy side, though, is simple, and that is Republicans have argued very, very strongly against more stimulus, and that the first stimulus they claim didn't work. There's huge debate on that, with a lot of economists believing that it did have a pretty big impact. But it means that on the political side, the argument for further stimulus, further deficit spending to pay for that stimulus, if Democrats do that, they play into Republican campaign themes for the fall and seem so far not to be very interested in having that fight.
The war in Afghanistan, now 8 years. Isn't that amazing? 8 years, 8 months. Any progress?
Maybe some, but it's very hard to judge, in part because with the buildup of newer forces and the expansion of U.S. forces into areas that we had previously at least not been fully engaged in, we've seen an escalation of some fighting. We've certainly seen an escalation of U.S. troop casualties and deaths there, with some arguments that there have been improvements, that some of the local conditions are better or local alliances are better, but not any kind of wholesale evidence of big improvements. We've also seen more success in the last year and a half in targeted assassinations of leaders of Al-Qaeda and of the Taliban using largely drone aircraft partly in Pakistan and partly in Afghanistan. So in that sense, there are some demonstrable changes in success, if you count it that way. But I think here the problem is, what do you know is success? How do you count success?
Yes.
In Iraq, it was partly the rate of bombings of civilians. In part, it was the death toll of U.S. troops, but also civilian death tolls. We saw those move sharply down in 2007 and towards the end of 2007 after the surge and after General Petraeus came in and shifted ground strategy there some. Here in Afghanistan, we have not yet seen either a comparable surge in deaths and attacks, nor have we seen a comparable decline in those things. So it's very hard to judge just how much progress we're making.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them momentarily. Professor Charles Franklin in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-founder of Pollster, S-T-E-R, P-O-L-L-S-T-E-R.com is our guest this hour. Later in the hour, E.J. Dionne will be with us. Our number, 800-486-8655. We've already touched on the Gulf, on job picture not being as strong as the administration would like, and on Afghanistan. Feel free to comment on those areas or wherever you would like to take us politically this hour. Phone lines are open for you. I'm Kathleen. Oh, we also have an email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our favorite librarian, Nancy Pearl, will be with us the second hour of our program. She's currently working on a book on travel, and we're asking, what are your favorite travel books? And she'll also give recommendations of books you should take as you travel during these summer months. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, Professor Charles Franklin, Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison, is our guest for the first half hour of our program today. And we go to Tom from Burlington. Hi.
On April 1st, President Obama opened up the offshore lands to oil drilling. And there's several questions. when somebody sits down and decides he's going to do something, you wonder if he asks the right question. I mean, what is the most important question the president has to do when he's talking to these people? And maybe have a list of these questions. What's going to happen if this happens? What's going to happen if that happens? And it makes you wonder. When I was going to school, I went to school with Jesuits for 12 years or however long I was in school. And at the end of the whole process, I said to myself, you know, I've spent all this time in this school is to learn a question, how to ask a question, and what question to ask. The Jesuits didn't give you any answers. And it just makes me, if somebody ought to maybe just write a list of questions that a president should ask when he sits down within a department and decides he's going to change a big policy. And my next thing is, my question is, what was Mr. Obama doing in Iowa making a speech out there when the problem was in Louisiana?
Professor Franklin.
Okay. Well, those Jesuits trained you well. It's asking the right question is one of the biggest problems. I think that the issue here is kind of paradoxical. It's true that we have not had a deep-sea oil rig have this kind of disaster in the U.S. region anyway in a very long time. So I think it builds a kind of overconfidence. And paradoxically, it means that we don't get much experience in dealing with one that goes bad because we haven't had one in a long time. So I think, you know, very much the way after we have an airplane crash, the National Transportation Safety Board goes in and really investigates and pulls apart what happened there. I think that's got to be the case here, and certainly it looks like it will be, because the blowout preventer that was supposed to make this nearly impossible obviously failed and failed horribly. And so I think one of the issues here is that when you get lulled into a sense of overconfidence that the system is working and can't go wrong and that the potential big downside really is so unlikely that we just start to ignore it, I think that's the real issue in sort of what should the president ask about it. And, of course, the flip side is that our energy situation has not changed at all since before or after this. The issue of whether we should be expanding domestic production is still just as much on the table as it was. But now with this vivid reminder that oil drilling comes with potentially real consequences. As for Obama's travel, I think this is really a question of should the president ever put himself in a position of being so dominated by a single issue that he can't focus on anything else. And I think the White House has clearly decided that they would prefer to stay engaged in other issues and other kinds of things that a president does day to day rather than hunker down and get a bunker mentality that it's all the oil spill all the time, especially when the extent to which they can do much about the oil spill is pretty limited. The government doesn't have the ability to go in and turn off the tap at the well site. Obviously, they would have if they could. And they claim, at least, they're devoting considerable resources to the cleanup, even though there the perception is certainly not as favorable as their claims.
The problem with that is the news cycle, because it is the oil spill all the time on nightly news and certainly on a lot of cable news as well. So it defines what people, or at least the news media, think should be the nonstop issue.
I think that's right. Though, interestingly, recent polling, the CBS poll this past week, found that environmental issues, including the oil spill, are not at the top of the public agenda. The economy remains the number one concern of people right now. Clearly, that could change if the oil landing on the shores of, you know, everything from Louisiana to Florida increases, and with long-term coverage of it. But the economy still remains the most important issue in people's minds. That may be the one thing that's actually protecting the Obama administration, paradoxically. All of this negative coverage about the oil spill is not yet at the top of the public's mind.
Wayne in Eau Claire, hi. Wayne, are you there? All right, Wayne's not there. Jim from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I'd like to share some core points for people to think about. First, Murphy's Law works. What can go wrong will. Secondly, deregulation failed, and yet it's a major intellectual concept of the Republicans and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. What's up with that? Thirdly, I think Obama's actions and sellout on oil drilling manifests the idea that we got to nominate and elect liberals, and that the primaries are very important in the process. Fourth, the media gets caught up in diversions. For example, Sarah Palin Spence, as Keith Olbermann would say, Saranoia. You know, we've got to get the media to focus on important issues. And the final point is that is the framing of the use of tax dollars. Tax and spend is associated with liberals, but in reality, the Republicans use taxes to support their programs. And for example, the subsidy or the opposition to or proposal of having small limits as far as liability for BP, which the Republicans are working for in the Senate, trying to obstruct the raising of the limits, constitutes a hidden tax on the American people, designed to benefit the oil companies. And the cost of the cleanup of the Gulf and the possible East Coast cleanup and the possible carrying of the oil inland by hurricanes and the possible destruction of New Orleans because of the destruction of the wetlands are all costs that should be assumed by the oil companies, not bounced down to the states and the American people. And if we did that, then we'd have more money for things like job creation.
Professor Franklin.
There's a lot there. I'm going to focus on the point about regulation, because I think what we do see right now is that regulation is back, at least to some extent. We're seeing it with financial regulation reform, which is pending in Congress but seems likely to pass. And I think in the wake of this, we'll see certainly significant changes in regulation of environmental issues. Likewise, mine safety with the West Virginia mining disaster a couple of months ago. So I think the kinds of deregulation that happened in the 80s and 90s is seeing some pushback here, and we will see some modifications to it. How far and to what extent, I think, still remains up in the air.
And thanks for your call. One more call for you, Barbara in Madison. Hello.
Oh, good morning. And Professor Franklin, I so value hearing your opinions. Thank you so much.
Well,
and Kathleen,
thank you very much.
You're always right on. But here's my feeling, Professor Franklin. The fact that Canada approaches this situation of oil drilling very differently than we do, and I just wonder, if we don't, you know, if we never get campaign finance reform in this country, we have the lobbyists lining our lawmakers' pockets, and we don't get the kind of laws that we really should have to protect the public. And I'm dismayed at this at the local level and the national level. What do you think?
I there are two sides to this, so I'll argue the unpopular side just to balance things off. There's no question that campaign contributions play a huge role, so I'm not going to go there. I think we all agree on that. But I think the problem here is that we also have a real interest in energy production and other kinds of the financial system and so on. And so the government is put in a difficult position of trading off restrictions which prevent those industries from working efficiently against protecting us from bank failures and oil spills and so on. And this leads to a situation in which we're always faced with corporate interests which represent real economic problems for the country being played against the sort of protections for the public. For whatever reason, our country has more often than not gone more with allowing the corporate interests to have a major role in that, and our parties have been on both sides unwilling to ultimately put very strong draconian regulations on them. So that's the unpopular view about this, that these are real economic interests and you regulate them at your peril for economic growth over the long haul. How much of that is related only to campaign finances? I'm not sure. A good bit of it, who knows how much. Finally, our system of regulation produces what we saw in the mineral resources people and BP. Close regulation leads to back and forth between industry and government and back to industry and into lobbying. And those kinds of connections always lead to more influence for organized economic interests and less for disorganized publics.
And then you have the AP report today that more than half of the federal judges in districts where the bulk of the Gulf oil spill-related lawsuits are pending have financial connections to the oil and gas industry.
That's right. This is because what are the major industries? How do you make a living if you're a lawyer in Texas and Louisiana? Mm-hmm. One of the major ways to do that is to be connected with the oil industry in some way. That's not nefarious. That's part of making a living. It's part of what drives the economy. I think one of the biggest ironies right now is Governor Jindal and some of the others in southern Louisiana saying don't halt new drilling and new exploration because 80% of our Gulf economy is driven by that. So it's terrible that the fisher folk are being put out of business along here, but the size of their economic impact is far smaller than the impact of oil production and exploration. And so you really see beautifully illustrated there, at least beautifully from a political scientist's point of view, the conflict between the economic engine that drives the Louisiana economy and the terrific impact that it's having on that much smaller part of the Louisiana economy and its environment. And so whatever plays out here, I think from a political scientist point of view, is a very interesting example of this tension between what does the state and the people there need in order to get their, you know, their paychecks every
right.
month.
Yeah.
And what are these horrible impacts that we're seeing along the shore as the oil washes up and kills wildlife as well as the vegetation there.
Professor Franklin, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Professor Charles Franklin, professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-founder of Pollster.com. E.J. Dionne is joining us now, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, syndicated columnist for the Washington Post. He is the author of a number of books. He spent 14 years with the New York Times reporting on state and local government and from around the world. Joined the Post in 90 as a reporter covering national politics. His books include Why Americans Hate Politics. He began his op-ed column for the Post in 1993. He's also author of Sold Out, Reclaiming That's S-O-U-L-E-D, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, and other books as well. We'll continue all things political and welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. One of your latest pieces says that the president needs to establish that he's doing all he can to repair the damage in the Gulf, even as he maintains his focus on the economy. Let's talk about the economy. Our last guest said that in public opinion polls, the economy is still number one. It is not the Gulf. The unemployment figures numbers were not very good from a couple days ago. What can the president do to strengthen this economy and get people back to work?
Well, the first thing he can do, I think, is persuade Democrats in Congress, forget the Republicans who aren't going to vote with him, but Democrats in Congress, that the job of getting out of the economic mess is not yet completed. And I was struck a couple weeks ago when even in the House, which is supposed to be the more liberal collection of Democrats, they couldn't get a full stimulus package through. They're not calling it stimulus anymore. They're calling it jobs bills. But there are, you know, help for those who are losing their health insurance in the downturn and some other matters, $23 billion, so school systems won't have to lay off anywhere between 100,000 and 300,000 teachers. When a Democratic Congress can't pass such things, you've got a problem. And I think The president's difficulty is that he is sending two messages at the same time. They're both right, but they are in conflict. On the one hand, he's saying we need more stimulus now. On the other hand, he's saying, but yes, we're going to get the deficit under control. But I think the deficit message from Obama has been so strong that it's actually undercut his efforts to keep pumping some money in the economy, because when you've got 9.7% unemployment, you have not yet fixed the economy.
What about the effects of the first stimulus? Has he made the case, and can he make the case, that it helped the economy?
The hardest slogan to sell in politics is it could have been a whole lot worse.
Right.
And I think it's very clear, anybody, I don't like to make sweeping statements like this, but I think it's true in this case. Anybody who's really looked at the economics of it has to say that the first stimulus helped keep us from going off the cliff. It helped keep unemployment from going a whole lot higher. It has created directly or indirectly best estimate now is around 2.5 million jobs, more in the private sector than in the public sector. So the stimulus worked. It just wasn't big enough. And I think that was one of the products of the compromises he had to make right at the beginning of his administration to get the stimulus through. So it's worked, but it's very hard for people to get their heads around the idea that it worked when unemployment is still so high. That's why I think it's unfortunate that he didn't get a chance to push through right at the beginning a stimulus of the size that we needed so that we could later turn to the deficit. But the worst thing that could happen to the deficit is if this downturn lingered, if the recovery continues to be sluggish. That's why the deficits are so big. Tax revenues are way down because a lot of people aren't working and a lot of other people aren't making as much money as they used to.
Right. Let's go back to those teachers for a moment. Those numbers are so high of the teachers who are facing layoffs. The problems with that, of course, is that classroom sizes are going to go up fairly significantly. Is there a way to address that specific problem? I've talked to a lot of teachers recently who are losing jobs or who are worried about their jobs. And parents, of course, are worried about their children's education.
The problem here is, in a sense, the same as the problem at the federal level, which is a lot of counties and cities and states are seeing their revenue base drop because of the economic downturn, and they're having to cut everywhere. And for a lot of places, education is, and rightly so, one of the very biggest expenditures. So you have some really radical things happening in some states. Some states are moving toward a four-day week
Yes.
for schools, Hawaii, for example. And that's a terrible idea. And there's a great irony, I think, in all of the talk about the deficit. We say that we should cut the deficit because we care about our children's future. And that's fair enough. We shouldn't be saddling our kids with piles of debt to pay for ongoing expenses, including, I would note, two wars. But if there is anything bad for the future of our children, it's these severe cutbacks in the schools. The stimulus bill actually helped prevent the layoff of a lot of teachers, a lot of cops, a lot of firefighters, but that money runs out. And the idea is, okay, the economy still isn't as strong as we hoped. These jurisdictions are still facing the need to cut expenditures and therefore to do these layoffs. Let's give them another reprieve until the economy gets back and their revenue base is back in shape.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Our first caller is Peter in Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Am I being naive in thinking and or hoping that things are so bad here in the United States that we'll decide that we can no longer sustain a war effort in Afghanistan?
Well, I think you're going to see a real debate about that coming up. Here's what I think. I think, and I've talked to opponents of the war about this recently, I think there's a general view on that side of politics that the time to have the real debate over Afghanistan is next year when the president had promised to begin withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. I think this year you'll see some debate, and you are sort of drawing down troops from Iraq. But I think more generally, I think my own view is that The president, faced with a whole lot of bad options, probably picked the best one, which is to try to create a situation in which it's possible to withdraw down the road. But more generally, I think you really are going to see a debate about how you match our foreign policy, and particularly our use of military interventions, to our willingness and ability to pay for this. One of the things that I've been upset about since we started the Iraq War is the notion that if this really is as important as President Bush said it was, why in the world wasn't he willing to ask Americans to pay for it? And so I think you're going to see in this debate over the budget not only a debate over entitlements, and really it's a debate over the cost of health care, but also a debate over whether the military budget can't take some hits along with the rest of the government. So I think this issue is going to be out there, and I think next year is when you're going to see the big debate on Afghanistan.
But, E.J., what is the situation that needs to be created in Afghanistan so we can leave, and why haven't we been able to do that in 8 years and 8 months?
Well, if we spent a lot of that 8 years fighting a war in Iraq while things were getting worse in Afghanistan, I mean, I don't mean to blame everything on the previous administration, but I do think in this case they really let go of the policy in Afghanistan. And so now we have to sort of double back and say, how can we prevent large parts of the country from getting into the hands of the Taliban? I think what you're seeing is, one potentially hopeful sign is that there's a view that some folks who have been fighting with the Taliban, folks is a funny word to use in this context, some of the people fighting for the Taliban are willing to enter negotiations to withdraw their support from the Taliban in exchange for some power sharing with the current government. And, if you go back to General McChrystal's own report, there was an honest contradiction right in the middle of it. I say it that way because McChrystal was honest in saying, the strategy he's pursuing depends on having a decent government to turn over authority to, and we know there are deep problems of corruption and some real opposition to the Karzai government. It's a very, very hard thing to solve. I think what we are looking to do is to create a circumstance where we, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan, where the forces that are genuinely hostile to the United States are weakened enough that we can leave, keeping the situation under control to the people in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But I don't think anyone who's honest about this thinks there is any simple solution to this problem. I think we're going to live with it for a long time.
E.J. Dionne is our guest for this part of All Things Political. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl is our guest, the second hour of the program, currently writing a book on her favorite travel books of all times, and she has a phenomenal memory for books and will give you suggestions of what you would like to read during this summer. Okay, back to phone calls. E.J. Dionne is our guest. Mike in Appleton, hello.
Yeah, I have two questions for your guest. The first one has to deal with Iran. As we're going through all of turmoil with the economy and the oil spill and everything else that goes on, one would get the impression that there's something incremental going on between Israel and let's call it the Arab nations. And frankly, I'm deeply concerned about Iran getting a nuclear weapon. I just can't envision a world with them having that sort of capability and sitting on top of all of that oil.
All right, let's take that one first. E.J.?
The politics of the Middle East is not exactly transparent. I think that the latest difficulties between Israel and the Palestinians because of the episode with the ship going to Gaza complicates what I think was a developing consensus that Iran getting a nuclear weapon is a dangerous thing. It's not just the Israelis who believe that. There are a lot Sunni Arab countries that believe that, including obviously Saudi Arabia, I suspect Jordan. And so I think that there is the possibility of slowly building consensus against this and strengthening sanctions and the like. Unfortunately, at the moment, with the it's much harder to arrive at that consensus because of the new conflicts, that have come up as a result of that ship. But I think, I think there is some, if you will, political material to work with in opposing Iran. And, one of the striking things is, we don't seem to know a whole lot about whether the current regime is as stable as it appears to be on the surface. That was a powerful opposition movement that arose. I have a feeling that time is on the side of the opponents of that regime. Unfortunately, the timeline on the nuclear weapon and the timeline on the, a strong challenge to that regime may not be exactly as we'd like. But it is a real challenge. And the caller is right. We have so many big problems on the front burner that this prospect is not one of them, at least in terms of public attention.
Thanks, Mike. We need to talk about oil, EJ. You write that the president can't afford to let oily waters engulf his priorities. You listed in your column what the president has done, and I didn't hear the Saturday radio address, but I didn't know those figures, the number of vessels that are out there to assist in the cleanup, the National Guard troops, et cetera. He's been curiously silent about the help that's been going there. How should he be handling this spill, and what do you mean when you say he can't let these oily waters engulf his priorities?
Well, in the column today, I talked about the double bind he's in. On the one hand, the administration itself acknowledges that at the very least, they mismanaged communications in the early part of this spill. They seem to be trying to keep a certain public distance from it. They obviously didn't want the country to blame the government for this spill. They wanted the country to blame BP. But in the process, they did not call any attention to the things that they were actually doing, and the president seemed a little detached. Their argument, in a way, is like that old argument about Wagner's music. It's better than it sounds, and they're saying our response is a whole lot better than it looked. And so having been slow to explain what they were doing, they are now trying to be all over this and saying, look at all of the things we have done. And I think, in fairness, they did do a lot more than they bragged about or than was reported in those early days. But it was a mistake. And as I mentioned, the last thing a president wants is to have an argument over whether this crisis is closer to Katrina or closer to the tick, tick, tick of the Iran hostage crisis under Jimmy Carter. So they want to get out from under that. The problem is they also face this continuing sluggish economy. And so my argument in the column was simply that, yes, they have to deal with this spill. The damage is extraordinary. They have the misfortune of the president endorsing offshore drilling a couple weeks before this rig blows up. So they got to deal with all that. But they cannot lose sight of the fact that ultimately the vast majority of the country is going to judge them on how the economy is doing both this November and 2 years from now. The line that's gone through my head a lot lately is that old song, Mama Said There'd Be Days Like This. I think in Obama's case, he just didn't realize how many days like this there were going to be. It's a hard time to be president.
Yes, it is. Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I guess I wanted to go back to the economy and I think that's really at the heart of it, what it's all about. I mean, Carville said it's the economy, stupid. I mean, you've got 40,000 private sector jobs that were created, and we all know that you need more than double that just to keep up with new people entering the labor market. Couple that with now you've got the summer when unemployment rates typically go up because you've got college students coming back trying to enter the labor market. And it's just the perfect storm. And this new jobs bill, I guess I'm looking at it as, okay, you had a bite at the apple to start with. You said if we pass this bill, unemployment won't go above 8%. Well, we know that didn't work out because you said we didn't know how bad it was, which I'll give him credit for that. He didn't know how bad it was. But at the same time, this $700 billion stimulus bill, which was really geared towards a lot of public sector and municipalities, which don't create lasting jobs, because when that money runs out, you have a situation now where you're going to have to lay people off. And only about a half of it has been spent. So the size of our economy, when you look at it from an economist standpoint, injecting $350 billion into the economy our size really doesn't do much.
Okay, EJ.
Well, you know, it's, again, the problem they've had in ever. The Republicans won the battle, public relations battle, over the stimulus. The fact is that the biggest part of the stimulus were tax cuts that went directly into people's paychecks and were spent right away. There were tax cuts for middle-income, lower-income people, not you, and you know, kind of across the board. But it was money that was spent right away. And also, those more money for what we call the automatic stabilizers, help to keep health insurance, help to the unemployed, that money gets spent right away. So the bulk of that money actually did go right back into the private economy. There just wasn't enough of it. And then the other part of it is, when people look at the money spent in the public sector, well, if you keep a fireman or a cop or a teacher in their job as opposed to out of their job, they have money in their pockets to spend. So that also stimulates the private economy. But implicit in what the caller said, if I get him right, I agree with his implicit point, which is they didn't take a big enough bite of the apple when they had that bite at the beginning. And in terms of public relations mistakes, I think the largest was made by whoever kept that 8% figure in the projection. The projections were starting to change around the time they put those numbers out. And the Republicans have run with that number and said, see, they said unemployment without the stimulus would go up to 8%. Now it's at 9.7. I don't blame the Republicans for hanging that around the administration's neck. It was a big mistake, and they should have seen that coming at the time.
Thanks, Scott. Time for one more phone call. Clark in Madison. Hi, Clark.
Hi. Thanks for taking me. I didn't know if you were going to be able to or not, because I'm off base on my little comments. First is, I'd like to see a system whereby there is high-quality early childhood care and education for our youngsters so that they can have good results in grade school and secondary school and go to college and learn some. We don't have such an animal now. There's no such thing as a high-quality early childhood education network. That has to happen. And it can only happen with federal funds, of course, because you have to make it so that people with less incomes are required to pay lower tuitions. And if that happens, you're going to have a bunch of smarties who know how to solve everything in the first place. Secondly, if you make the money happen for the consumers, early childhood parents, and leave the grasping of the excess money to the child care employees, that's great, and it can happen if you change the labor laws just based upon the currently talked about. If you sign a card, you get a vote.
EJ.
Well, there's a lot in there. I'll just focus on the early childhood part. There is a lot of research that says that the money you put into early childhood education pays itself off, because you really can create better test scores later, better learning. Kids are more ready to learn in school. Therefore, they progress and can get decent jobs in the workforce. We are at a moment right now where we're just having trouble keeping teachers in elementary and elementary schools and high schools on the payroll. I do hope we someday take a look more seriously at exactly what the caller said, because I know this not only from, this is not just a liberal thing. There are a lot of middle-of-the-road fiscal hawks who say, if you're going to spend public money, this is one area where the investment can really be called an investment and where it pays off.
And I keep thinking about what you said earlier, and I've been struck by it before. The fact that schools are going to 4 days a week is just astounding, isn't it, EJ? It's where are our priorities?
Well, you know, the caller made the point about Afghanistan earlier. I do hope this question gets closely linked to the debate over Afghanistan, because the appropriation for the teachers is $23 billion. The appropriation for Afghanistan, if I have the number right, is somewhere around $32 billion. It does seem to me not unreasonable to ask that if we can invest the $32 billion for our security in Afghanistan, we ought to, in the short run, be able to invest $23 billion to keep all these teachers from being laid off. And, you know, the administration has spent a lot of money on education reform. They're trying to force change into the system, and I think that's a positive thing. But you can't sort of, on the one hand, sort of try to be doing the reforms and, on the other hand, be undercutting right. the whole base of our public education system.
EJ, thank you so much. You're a wonderful guest. Thank
it's
you.
It's great to have you.
Thanks.
Great to be with you, Rhonda.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, EJ. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Rhonda Fanning for doing on-air production as well. We'll return in just a moment following the news.